To the Untold History Channel. My name is Ron Partain, and we're going to have a little bit of fun again. We're going to start going down. I'm going to read another one of Mike's books. This is called St. Joseph of Wisconsin. Just so that I can give it a good kind of intro, this is... Oh, doggone it. What just happened there? Sorry, guys. My computer acted up and I lost all my, I lost everything. Where did it go? Doggone it. Like all my windows closed. So, give me one second here. The heck just happened? Sorry, guys. This is a little embarrassing. I don't know what, I do not know what happened, but like all my windows closed all at the same time. And everything that I had up to read is like stuck down in a tab on the bottom. So give me a second here as I regroup. Let's see. Okay. All righty. Okay, so this is St. Joseph of Wisconsin, the heroic true story of Senator Joseph McCarthy that the fake news and fake historians don't want you to know. Who was Joseph McCarthy, and why is he, without question, hands down the most widely and most viciously vilified personage in American history? The official version of history, written by academic operatives serving the same ruling class with which McCarthy sought to expose, teaches us that the Wisconsin senator was a nasty, bullying brute who dirtied the reputations of anyone who disagreed with him politically. As the story goes, if one was a liberal, the demagogue McCarthy slandered him as a communist, and just like that, an innocent man or woman was ruined. McCarthy's mole hunting came to be known as McCarthyism, a derogatory term still used today to describe political slanderers. More than 60 years after his crusade against red traitors was stopped in its tracks, American school children who learn very little about history, real or fake, will surely learn about the evil Joe McCarthy, and it's all a pack of slickly packaged lies. The history of Joe McCarthy is a story that absolutely must be corrected, not merely for the sake of academic scholarship, but more importantly, because the very same conspiracy so immense that ultimately destroyed McCarthy is still alive and well today, and more dangerous than ever. This is the true story of Senator Joseph McCarthy, St. Joseph of Wisconsin. Hallowed be his unjustly dirtied name. So that is the that is what I'm going to be reading here. And before I jump into this, I did a quick little kind of 3-minute video earlier today about my little boy, and he is boy, I tell you, it's like nothing happened. He's back at 100%. He is he's eaten like he's hungrier than a horse. It's crazy. I don't know what happened, but it's the greatest Christmas present that I could get. Truly, I hated him. I hated having to go through all that. I was so dog tired, wasn't sleeping much. But I'm sure that you guys can appreciate that. So anybody who's got kids or pets or whatever knows how special those guys they get. To you. So, but, I appreciate every single one of you guys, your prayers and the donations that helped. I assure you that, getting to the point where I went to go see the surgeon and was ready to pay the money to do that was, it was not an inexpensive, venture. So, you know, those of you who were kind enough to contribute, it was extremely helpful, I assure you. So just, you know, but those who didn't and just, you know, were just your thoughts, they oozed from the comments and I could just tell. So, you know, I sincerely appreciate every single one of you guys. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. So, let's see here. Let's see, just looking at, I did an interview / discussion this morning, or earlier today with Scott Bennett. It was just supposed to be Scott and I. And I happened to be on the phone with Rob Cunningham, and I was like, "Hey, do you want to join me?" I do this thing with Scott, and he said, "Oh, are you kidding? I'd love to. I totally admire Scott." So it just kind of like at the very last second became a threesome with Rob, and man, he truly added an amazing amount of bulk and substance to the conversation. And you know, I've done a lot of videos, but I gotta say that one that I did earlier today with Rob and Scott is cool, was almost one of my favorites, just right out of the gate. It was one of those things. It was a very special conversation. A lot of the things that you know, Scott did, his bravery going over into a combat zone, was, you know, something to be, there's got to give credit where credit is due. And, I guess there was a lot of people that they reached out to, you know, that they invited to go over there to do that. Scott Ritter, I think is it that, I want to say Douglas MacArthur, and that's not right. Douglas, just having a brain fart. Anyway, a lot of guys that they invited to go over, and they declined to go, but Scott went. And I kind of said, "Man," I said, "I would have gone." And he's like, "Well, maybe next time." So that was fun. So thank you, Safir. I appreciate you say that. You have insurance for them, and it's $175 a month for all four. Interesting. I'd be curious to know about that. My email address is on the Untold History Channel at Gmail. Shoot me an email. I'd be curious to talk to you about that. Seriously. So, because they're not, man, it's like a freaking racket, man, I swear. But anyway, guys, let's jump into this. This is probably going to be the book is 274 pages, but it's, you know how Mike writes, that's big text and a lot of pictures and whatnot. So we probably get through this in, I'm guessing, 4 or 5 shows, maybe six, but doubtful. 4 to 5, probably enough. But kind of along the lines of kind of what I've been talking about lately with the whole communism thing and whatnot, I think this is extraordinarily apropos, because McCarthy tried to expose all these people who had infiltrated the government. And that's why he was vilified so ardently. So, I think this will be really good. And I know, you know, I will say several people have reached out to me, and they like it when I read. They don't like it when they come here and I just play videos. They would prefer that I talk and give my, as opposed to playing a video, they prefer to hear me talk about stuff. And I agree with that. I that's kind of what I've been wanting to do the last couple of days. It's, you know, my mind hasn't really been there. And I've also been struggling with the thing with my eye to read. So, but things are kind of getting on the mend here. So, I'm going to jump back in. We're going to do some more reading. So this is something that I really enjoy doing the reading. So anyway, on that note, let's jump in here and get started. So, and let me see here. Hello, Rainey and Liam and Colin and cute Patriot Grandma, Yarn, Colin. Well, nice to see you all tonight. And if any of you other guys that don't like participating in the chat, just, you know, I love it when you participate in the chat, just FYI. I love to see the chat go off. So feel no pressure to participate, but know that I enjoy it. And tomorrow, tomorrow I'm going to be playing a for the Friday Night Watch Party. I'm going to play. It's a mid '80s movie called Gulag, and it's a story of it's a fictitious story of like an American athlete who goes to Moscow to to cover it's kind of like an Olympic Games type thing, and winds up in the gulag. So it's a fictitious story. It's about an hour and 45 minutes, but around about 2 hours, I think, actually. But it's it'll be worth your time. It'll be a lot of fun. So it has a happy ending. So we'll leave it at that. All right, guys. Here we go. St. Joseph of Wisconsin. Let me make this. Let's see here. How can we account for our present situation unless we believe that men high in this government are concerting to deliver us to disaster? This must be the product of a great conspiracy, a conspiracy on a scale so immense as to dwarf any previous such venture in the history of man. A conspiracy of infamy so black that when it's finally exposed, its principles shall be forever deserving of the maledictions of all honest men. Senator Joseph McCarthy. It's a drink here. All right. Apparently, so this is Mike, obviously, and he was telling me about he's a cat guy too. He is a cat guy. So I knew I liked him. I knew I liked him for more than one reason. All right. Introduction. Who was Joseph McCarthy and why is he, without question, hands down the most widely and most viciously vilified personage in American history? The official version of history written by academics and... Did I just lose my place? Academic operative serving the same ruling class which McCarthy sought to expose teaches us that the Wisconsin senator was a nasty bullying brute who dirtied and sullied the reputations of anybody who disagreed with him politically, as the story goes. If one was a liberal, the demagogue McCarthy slandered him a communist, and just like that, the innocent man or woman was ruined. I kind of read that, actually. I didn't realize that... I read that from the website. I didn't know that it was part of the book. The History Channel. I'm guessing that this is a quote from the History Channel. Senator McCarthy spent almost 5 years trying in vain to expose communists and other left-wing loyalists or loyalty risks in the U.S. government. In the hyper-suspicious atmosphere of the Cold War, insinuations of disloyalty were enough to convince many Americans that their government was packed with traitors and spies. McCarthy's accusations were so intimidating that few people dared to speak out against him. All of these factors combined to create an atmosphere of fear and dread. feel the hatred from the establishment biographer and ex-communist Richard H. Rover, who described McCarthy thusly, an essentially destructive force, a chronic opportunist, a fertile innovator, a first-rate organizer and galvanizer of mobs, a skilled manipulator of public opinion, and something like a genius at that essential American strategy, publicity. A vulgarian, a man with an almost aesthetic preference for untruth, he made sages of screwballs and accused wise men of being fools. The first American ever to be actively hated and feared by foreigners in large numbers. He could not comprehend true outrage, true indignation, or true anything. The haters rallied around him. If you think about it logically and deductively, the sheer scope and intensity of the unremitting attacks against a man who died way back in 1957 can only mean one of two things. Either Joe McCarthy was an evil scumbag of such gross proportions that the wickedness of his deeds cannot and should not ever be forgotten by lovers of liberty and decency, or Joe McCarthy's dauntless crusade against treason in high places rattled the Reds and the globalist ruling class above them to such an extent that they want to make sure no one ever dares to attempt to expose the self-perpetuating powers that be ever again. As you may have already deduced by the title of this book, your McCarthy-loving investigative historian here believes or knows the latter case represents the true history. Yours truly does not believe in dishonesty hiding behind the veil of fake neutrality when presenting a historical case. The history of Joe McCarthy is a story that absolutely must be corrected, not merely for the sake of academic scholarship, but more importantly, because the very same conspiracy so immense that ultimately destroyed McCarthy is still alive and well today and more damaging and more dangerous than ever. This is the true story of Senator Joseph McCarthy. All right, we've been spoon-fed a 70-year diet of crap history about the evil that was McCarthyism. And I can vouch for that. And I'm sure a lot of you who are old enough, a lot of the younger people probably don't get it, but a lot of the old people, man, he was vilified on a massive, massive scale. All right, so chapter one, early years and personal life. Joseph Raymond McCarthy was born on November 14th of 1908 on a farm in a small town of Grand Chute, Wisconsin. He was fifth of seven children of an Irish immigrant mother and a father who was the son of an Irishman and a German mother. At 14, McCarthy dropped out of school to help manage the family farm. He later entered high school at age 20 and graduated in 1 year. McCarthy then worked his way through Marquette University, studying electrical engineering for 2 years, then law. Receiving a bachelor's of law degree, he was admitted to the Wisconsin bar in 1935. While working at a law firm, he ran an unsuccessful campaign for district attorney in 1936. In 1939, McCarthy ran and won the elected post of 10th District Circuit Judge. He became the youngest circuit judge in the state's history. Judge McCarthy acquired a reputation for being concise and efficient in speedily dispatching his cases, and his decisions were very seldom overturned by higher courts. The hardworking German-Irish farm boy became a lawyer, then a judge. Interesting. Shortly after the U.S. was secretly maneuvered into World War II by Franklin D. Roosevelt, McCarthy, despite the fact that his position exempted him from military service, voluntarily enlisted in the United States Marine Corps. His college education qualified him to enter the Marine Corps as a first lieutenant. He served as an intelligence briefing officer for a dive bombing squadron in the Pacific Theater of the War and was promoted to the rank of captain by the time he resigned his commission in April of 1945. During the war, he volunteered to fly in combat and combat missions in the dangerous capacity of a rear gunner. McCarthy thus acquired the nickname Tail Gunner Joe. After the war, he remained in the Marine Corps Reserve and attained the rank of major. He was later, in 1952, awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. Though critics claim that the honor was awarded because of his rising political stature. His Tail Gunner Joe nickname came to be sarcastically used as a term of mockery by his communist enemies. After leaving the Marines in 1945, McCarthy was reelected, unopposed to his circuit court positions. He then ran for the 1946 Republican Senate primary nomination and won again. In the general election against his Democrat opponent, Judge McCarthy won in a landslide. He would enter the U.S. Senate at the age of 38. Senator McCarthy soon became a sought-after public speaker. Many in the Washington social circles described the young senator as charming and friendly, and he was a popular guest at parties. He became active in the labor management issues, earning a reputation as a pro-labor Republican. He fought against continued price controls and was generally pro-business, too. In a 1949 incident for which the freshman senator would be widely criticized, McCarthy took a brave and lonely stand by advocating for the commutation of death sentences given to a group of Waffen-SS soldiers wrongfully convicted of massacring American prisoners of war in 1944. To the dismay of communists and some Jewish groups, McCarthy condemned the convictions because torture, repeated hard kicks to the testicles of the Germans, had been used to extract confessions. He charged the U.S. Army of engaging in a cover-up of this commonly used interrogation practice. Partially as a result of McCarthy's stand, the unjust death sentences of those accused of the Malmedy massacre were commuted to life imprisonment. Shortly after this event, a poll of the Senate Press Corps fake news rated McCarthy as the worst U.S. senator currently in office. In 1953, at the peak of his power and popularity, McCarthy married Jean Fraser Kerr, a researcher in his office. In 1957, the McCarthys adopted a baby girl whom they named Tierney Elizabeth. Let's see here. Chapter 2, The Truth About Karl Marx and Communism. Before we can even begin building the case to rehabilitate Joseph McCarthy and justify his crusade to root out the communists and globalists who had penetrated the federal government, a proper understanding of the evil and criminal folly of communism is essential, without which McCarthy would just appear to be a cruel persecutor of well-meaning people who simply had a different and innocently misguided philosophy of life and economics. Indeed, even many ardent anti-communists today remain under the mistaken impression that communism is only a fallacious government scheme for redistributing wealth, and that its disciples are merely stupid. Though there are, in fact, many well-intentioned fools in our midst who support communistic economics, these are what are called libtards. They are misinformed and often quite stupid, but they are not out to purposefully destroy civilization. If you pull a libtard aside and calmly reason with him or her, not an easy task, you might be able to correct the fallacious reasoning. Libtards are really not actually evil communists, just suckers. To digress a moment, nor is the ruling pro-business and pro-morality Communist Party of China actually communists anymore. For purposes of this book, we draw our distinction between communists and libtards based upon the observation of James Burnham, an ex-communist turned conservative. Burnham once wrote, "The difference between a communist and a liberal is that the communist knows what he's doing." You see, whereas noble-minded libtards actually believe in Karl Marx's high-sounding garbage, true communist subversives, Marx included, generally do not. The actual goal of Marxists and the higher globalist power controlling them was never about uplifting humanity, but always to degrade, control, and enslave us all under the what Marx referred to as the dictatorship of the proletariat or working class. In a May issue of the New York Times, a pay-to-view feature of his website, used to be called Tomato Bubble, but it's now it's Real News and History. Your humble author reporter here posted a piece which was extremely well received and widely acclaimed by the loyal readership. It was a line by line rebuttal of a pro-Marxist puff piece published by the New York Times. Consider it a crash course for understanding the true evil nature of totalitarian Marxism, communism, and why decent, ethical, freedom-loving people everywhere ought to mercilessly and relentlessly oppose this evil pseudo-philosophy and its cult followers. Here is the full piece. All right. May 2nd of 2018. Happy birthday, Karl Marx. You were right, by Jason Barker. And rebuttal. And actually, guys, this is what he does on a daily basis. Mike. He does this all the time. So the he puts out a daily thing where he rebuts something in the media. Rebuttal by the anti-New York Times. Good Lord, the Marxist scumbags at Sulzberger Slimes aren't even attempting to hide their true faces anymore. Though his bicentennial birthday isn't until May 5th, Karl Marx's fan base at the Slimes simply could not wait to publish this pro-Marxist opinion piece by professor of philosophy Jason Barker. Notwithstanding a few obligatory jabs at Marxism, Baker's take on Marx is essentially positive and very much in line with the shockingly provocative, even by Slime standards, headline, Happy Birthday, Karl Marx, You Were Right. But con artist Marx, though at times correct and passionately persuasive in calling attention to the injustices of capitalist society, the bait, was neither correct in his diagnosis of problems nor in his solutions to them. Let's examine Barker's barking at this and set the record straight. This must be Barker. he looks very communistic. Barker, educated liberal opinion today is more or less unanimous. Rebuttal, an educated liberal is an oxymoron. Though university-trained, libtards may be quite capable in certain fields of study, when it comes to matters philosophical or political, they are truly the most stupid, narrow-minded, stubborn, insecure, boot-licking, dim-witted, and uneducated specimens of humanity that this reporter has ever encountered, and I have known many of these types. Barker, in its agreement that Marx's basic thesis that capitalism is driven by a deeper divisive class struggle in which the ruling class minority appropriates the surplus labor of the working class majority as profit is correct. Rebuttal. No, that's not correct. It is the state, not the evil rich capitalists, which, though through both direct and indirect means, appropriates approximately 50% of the earnings of the average wage holder in America while working hand in hand with the government in its financing partner in crime, the Federal Reserve System or central bank, a counterfeiting slash loan sharking operation whose debt-based monetary system adds compounding public and private interest charges on top of taxes. Ironically, both the federal government and the Fed Bank are infested with Marxists and libtards. Barker, even liberal economists such as Nouriel Roubini agree that Marx's conviction that capitalism has an inbuilt tendency to destroy. Again, Bolshevik Barker, as previously stated, it is the ever-expanding indebted federal government, state and local too, and ever-inflating debt money Federal Reserve that are crushing so many working families into the ground, not capitalism or free enterprise. Barker, But this is where the unanimity abruptly ends. While most are in agreement about Marx's diagnosis of capitalism, opinions on how to treat it, its disorder, is thoroughly divided. Rebuttal. It doesn't matter if modern libtards are divided as to how to treat the disorder. If these Marxist morons all accept a faulty diagnosis which fails to take into account the crushing levels of taxation and inflation, and also the breakup of the nuclear family as the main sources of decreasing living standards, then all solutions are doomed to failure. Barker, and this is where Marx originally and profound importance as a philosopher lies. Rebuttal. Oh, what bloody stinking crap. Marx's only originality regarding solutions to the social problems he wrote about was to call for unlimited political power to be handed over to insane and unaccomplished jobless revolutionaries such as himself in a dictatorship of the proletariat. Then what? Barker. First, let it be clear. Marx arrives at no magic formula for exiting the enormous social and economic contradictions that global capitalism entails. Rebuttal. Ah, the obligatory truth gem. Thanks for that, Barker. So if Marx has no magic formula to make the world a better place, then he actually has no profound importance as a philosopher after all. Barker, what Marx did achieve, however, through his self-styled materialist thought, were the critical weapons for undermining capitalism's ideological claim to be the only game in town. Rebuttal. Wrong again, Barker. Marx was still in diapers, while thinkers far greater than he had already identified and fully diagnosed the injustices of the Rothschild on Britain, where Marx published many articles between 1850 and 1860, and European society in general. Though his stories were fictitional, Arthur Charles Dickens, during the decade before Marx's Communist Manifesto, severely critiqued the social situation in books such as Oliver Twist and A Christmas Carol. Going back even further, the genius Thomas Jefferson, in an 1816 letter to Samuel Kurzweil, and had this to say about the conditions in England. To preserve their independence, we must not let our rulers load us with perpetual debt. We must make our election between economy and liberty, of profusion and servitude. If we run into such debts as that, we must be taxed in our meat and in our drink, in our necessaries and our comforts, in our labors and our amusements, for our calling and our creeds, as the people of England are, our people, like them, must come to labor 16 hours in the 24, give the earnings of 15 of these to the government for their debts and daily expenses, and then to the 16th be insufficient to afford us bread. We must live as they do now, on oatmeal and potatoes, have no time to think, no means of calling the mismanagers to account, and but to be glad to obtain subsistence by hiring ourselves to rivet their chains on the necks of our fellow sufferers. Jefferson wrote those words 2 years before Marx's bitch of a mother had even pooped him out. So please, Mr. Barker, spare us this foolishness about Marx's originality in spotting the inequities and injustices of the day. Boy, he didn't really hide his disdain. Oh, that's kind of funny, actually. Marx is a Jew and is surrounded by a crowd of little, more or less intelligent, scheming, agile, speculating Jews, just as Jews are everywhere. Commercial and banking agents, writers, politicians, correspondents for newspapers in all shades, and in short, literally brokers, just as they are financial brokers, with one foot in the bank and the other in the socialist movement, and their arses sitting upon the German press. They have grabbed a hold of all newspapers, and you can imagine what a nauseating literature is the outcome of it. Now, this entire Jewish world, which constitutes an exploiting sect, a people of leeches, a voracious parasite, Marx feels and instinctive inclination and a great respect for the Rothschilds. This may seem strange. What could there be in common between communism and high finance? Ho ho. The communism of Marx seeks a strong state centralization, and where this exists, there must inevitably exist a state central bank. And where this exists, there is the parasitic Jewish nation, which speculates upon the labor of the people, will always find the means for its existence. In reality, this would be the proletariat, a Barak regime under which working men and the working closely and intimately connected with one another, regardless not only of frontiers, but of political differences as well. This Jewish world is today largely at the disposal of Marx or Rothschild. I am sure that on the one hand, the Rothschilds appreciate the merits of Marx, and that on the other hand, women converted into a uniform mass would rise, fall asleep, work and live, the beat of the drum. The privilege of ruling would be in the hands of the skilled and the learned, with a wide scope left for profitable crooks deals carried on by the Jews, who could be attracted by the enormous extension of the international speculations of the national banks. And that was Mikhail Bakunin in 1869. Wow, that was a lot. Barker, in the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels wrote, "The bourgeoisie has stripped of its halo every occupation hitherto honored and looked up to the reverent awe. It has converted the physician, the lawyer, the priest, the poet, the man of science into its paid wage laborers." Rebuttal. There is a bit of truth to that. The money grubbing of modern professionals, even worse today than in Marx's day, is undignified and degrading. But that's a problem of declining morals and ethics, not one of capitalism. And does it really require a philosopher to point that out? Finally, what's Marx's solution then? Total government takeover with the price and wage controls of all the professions? No thanks. Barker, the key factor in Marx's intellectual legacy in our present-day society is not philosophy, but critique on what he described in 1843 as the ruthless criticism of all that exists, ruthless both in the sense of not being afraid of the results it arrives at, and in the same sense of being just as a little afraid of conflict with the powers that be. The philosophers have only interpreted the world in varying ways. The point is to change it, he wrote in 1845. Translation, destroy, destroy, destroy. We'll figure out the solutions later on after the glorious revolution. Barker, racial and sexual oppression have been added to the dynamic of class exploitation. Social justice movements like Black Lives Matter and the Me Too, or hashtag Me Too, owe something of an unspoken debt to Marx, though their unapologetic targeting of the eternal truths of our age, such movements recognize, as did Marx, that the ideas that rule every society are those of its ruling class, and that of overturning those ideas is fundamental to true revolutionary progress. Translation, in the name of justice, destroy, destroy, destroy. Economy, politics, law, culture, art, history, science, literature, philosophy, music, morals, tradition, family, gender roles, and everything else, including millions of people. That is bourgeoisie. Destroy, destroy, destroy. Barker, but enlightened or rational thinking is not enough, since the norms of thinking are already skewed by the structures of male privilege and the social hierarchy, even down to the language we use. Charging those norms entails changing the very foundations of society. Rebuttal, and still, destroy, 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 the real meaning of change. Barker ironically manifests the same philosophical deficiencies as he attributed to Marx, in that he himself offers no solutions other than the revolutionary progress is the blind destruction of anything, and everything related to the existing societal order. Barker, the transition to a new society where relations among people rather than capital relations finally determine an individual's worth is arguably proving to be quite a task. And rebuttal, actually, Barker, Hitler, oh my God, did he just say the H word? Achieve that lofty ideal in only a few years' time. If you truly sincere about building a better world, not based on money, 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 you ought to have a look at what Germany achieved under National Socialism. Barker, as Marx, as I have said, does not offer a one-size-fits-all formula for enacting social change. Then drop the bearded ass clown already. But he does offer a powerful intellectual acid test for that change. Rebuttal, wrong again, Barker. The only intellectual acid test offered by Marx is the deadly and painful lessons learned from the many countries which suffered under the brutal misrule of his godless, heartless, soulless, brainless, traditionalist, and solutionless disciples with their empty promises. Fortunately, many of those states, Russia, China, Eastern Europe, later regained their senses and abandoned his junk philosophy. The true believing American and European libtards who remain oblivious to this reality that Marxism has always been and still is nothing more than a tool of domestic dismantlement used for totalitarian globalist objectives should do the same. End of rebuttal. We really hate the idea of having to summon up from the deepest pits of hell that drunken, cigar-chomping, plagiarizing, mass-murdering, homosexual, and possible boy rapist Winston Churchill to support our position, but in accordance with the principle that even broken clocks are right twice a day, we quote a line from his 1920 article about supporting Zionism over Bolshevism as a better path for the Jews, in which Wicked Winnie drops a profound truth gem about Marxism, aka Bolshevism. This movement among the Jews is not new. From the days of Spartacus Weishaupt to those of Karl Marx and down to Trotsky, Bela Kun in Hungary, Rosa Luxemburg in Germany, and Emma Goldman in the United States, this worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development of envious malevolence and impossibility, an impossible equality has been steadily growing. Tell it, Winnie, tell it. Envious malevolence, so true. Are you... sorry, guys. Need that water. Are you the product of a broken or dysfunctional family? Become a red. Your boss is a jerk? Become a red. No money and no job? Become a red. Rejected by the girl you want? Become a red. Not exactly the belle of the ball? Become a red. Hate white people? Become a red. At the top end of the communist spectrum, are you from an old line elite family with tons of money and high society privileges, but are bored to tears with your meaningless life and crave the excitement that comes with being a high-level conspirator? Become a red. Control freak? Become a red. Hate the healthy moral constraints associated with Christianity and religion in general? Become an atheistic red. Enjoy raping little boys and girls and even babies? Become a red. Don't actually care for Marxism, but want to magically advance your career in the arts, entertainment, business, or the sciences? Become a red. You know, I want to pause here for a second and say it's interesting to me that they're talking about enjoying raping little boys and girls and become a red. You know, I've understood this within the last couple of years, but in my kind of in my young years of understanding communism and Marxism and whatnot, I never really put together that they were essentially pedophiles, and that's kind of what he's saying here, and that's what a lot of people have said about communists. You know, I remember I remember I was listening to something about the church, the Catholic Church, and I mean no disrespect to the Catholic Church at all when I say this, but this person, I don't remember exactly where I heard it, but this person was talking about how the priesthood was a kind of like a hideout, if you will, for communists, specifically for like homosexuals, because they, you know, the priests, because they, you know, they had made this pledge of celibacy. They, you know, they could go to, you could go into the church and then you could have, you know, you could have orgies with other priests, but then you factor in the whole thing about bringing in the choir boys and having, you know, and pedophilia and whatnot. And that makes total sense to me. And, you know, we talk about how the church is corrupt and whatnot, and how all these communists and whatnot have gotten into the church. You know, I remember, in fact, I'm gonna do this here because I want to find it. Let's see here. Pope, what's his name? Pope Francis and Hammer and Sickle. There's a picture, there's a famous picture of him holding this hammer and sickle thing. And this is like from Time Magazine. Open image in New Tab. I don't know who's giving this thing, but, you know, I mean, this is so it's a hammer and sickle, and the hammer actually has Christ on this, on the cross, but the cross is the hammer. I mean, that's just, and that just, you know, it's sickening to me. But how these communists have basically just, you know, how they were brutal pedophiles, basically. Anyway, I digress. Don't actually care for Marxism, but want to magically advance your career in the arts. I already read that one. Membership, open or secret, in the communist parties of the world offered both the maladjusted misfits of the elite psychopaths described above, the perfect vehicle for getting even with or just getting ahead in the world at large. That is why communism, generally a tool of globalism, is not just wrong, but also very evil. And that's why Joe McCarthy and many others try to stop the spread of this deadly societal cancer. Let's see. I don't normally read these, but I'm going to read these one, this one. In the service to the House of Rothschild's grand conspiracy of the New World Order, the communists or anarchist red sub conspiracy attracted ugly and angry women. There's Senator Liz Warren. Degenerate sons of elite families, Alger Hiss, and angry working men who fell for Marxist phony demagogic rallying cries, workers of the world unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. Let's see here. Chapter 3. I'm probably going to end on the chapter 3 here tonight, guys. It's I know it's a shorter video, but I did that one longer one this morning, and I actually got some stuff I got to get done. From the mid-1800s up until today, or up until McCarthy's day, under a phony banner of liberty and equality, the intertwined communists and anarchists, both known as Reds, terrorized the existing governments of Europe and America by murderous acts, which they themselves referred to as a propaganda of the deed. This highly destabilizing tactic of terror allowed the Red bosses and their globalist masters to essentially exterminate kings, queens, presidents, prime ministers, and other important leaders without them having to get too close to the killing. The word would go forth to the deranged and hate-filled Redfoot soldiers, and one of them would carry out what were sacrifice attacks in which the assassin was almost always caught or killed in the act. The dirty deed would make these Reds martyrs famous and inspire other insane pawns to commit high-profile murders, hence the term propaganda of the deed. Following are just a few historical examples from Europe. In April of 1886, the first assassination attempt on Alexander II is made by a Red terrorist. 1 year after the murder of U.S. President Lincoln, his ally, Russian Tsar Alexander II, also came under fire when Red revolutionary Dmitry Karakozov fired his pistol at him. The attempt was thwarted by a quick-thinking bystander. Karakozov was captured and executed. 10 of his Red accomplices were arrested and sentenced to hard labor. Alexander Nearly, 1874, Red's attempt to kill Chancellor Bismarck. A Red named Frederick Cohen had previously shot German Chancellor Bismarck when he was Prime Minister of Prussia in 1866. Red terrorist Edward Coleman again attempted to assassinate him. Coleman's gunshot struck Bismarck's hand. Kaiser Wilhelm I and Chancellor von Bismarck were the peacemakers of Europe, but Rothschild's New World Order crime gang wanted these leaders dead so that mighty Germany could be subdued under their thumb. May 11 and June 2nd of 1878, Reds make two assassination attempts against Kaiser Wilhelm I. In the days just before the important pro-Russo-Turkish War International Conference, or Congress of Berlin, was due to take place in Berlin, two assassination attempts were made against Kaiser Wilhelm I. On May 11th of 1878, a Red named Emil Max Hodel fired shots at the emperor and his daughter as they traveled in their carriage. Hodel was captured and then executed. Hodel was captured and then executed in August. 3 weeks later, another Red named Karl Nobling fired a gun at the emperor. The 82-year-old Kaiser was wounded, but he survived. Nobling then shot himself and died of his wounds 3 months later. April of 1879, December 1879, and February of 1880, three more assassination attempts on Alexander II. The New World Order Red crime gang was relentless in its obsession to murder Russian Tsar Alexander II. One attempt had already failed in 1866. In April of 1879, a Red named Alexander Soloviev made another attempt in St. Petersburg. In December of the same year, a Red group calling itself the People's Will tried to blow up the Tsar with explosives. 2 months later, the Red terrorist Stefan Kalternerin detonated a bomb intended to kill the Tsar at a dinner party. The Tsar was late for dinner, but 11 others were killed and 30 wounded. In March of 1881, communist terrorists finally kill Alexander II. After four previous attempts, Rothschild's Red terrorists finally succeeded in assassinating Tsar Alexander II of Russia. With his son Alexander III and grandson Nicholas watching, the Marxists hurled bombs at Alexander. His legs were blown off and he bled to death. Due to the presence of so many Jews in the revolutionary movement, anti-Semitic sentiment swept across Russia after the Tsar's murder. The subsequent pogroms, though greatly exaggerated for propaganda purposes, helped to trigger a wave of Jewish immigration to the United States, England, and Germany. Many of these Jewish immigrants brought their radical politics with them and continued to agitate against Christian Russia from their newly adopted nations. You know, it's interesting that they say they would leave and they'd bring their politics with them. Think about how people in California are viewed around the country. I remember, that's kind of a funny little story. I remember when I was in the Navy and I was in school when we were doing our, I was learning how to be a weatherman at this Air Force base in Chanute Air Force Base. It was a little town about 150 miles south of Chicago. And we went for one of the guys there was he was from Newport, Kentucky, which is right across the river from Cincinnati. One weekend we got a car and we drove over to where he was. And somewhere we got over there and we stopped, and it was four of us. And we met a car of young girls, and you know, they asked, hey, where are we going? You know, where are you guys from or whatnot? And everybody, I was the last one to go, but everybody said where they were from. And I said I was from California. And one of the girls there, like, just squealed, like, so happy that, like, oh my God, he's from California. And it was kind of funny. I'll never forget that. But the point that I'm making there is that when I was young, to be from California was like, I mean, everybody wanted to be like, oh my God, it's so, like, awesome. You're from California. And now, you know, 40 years, 30 years later, now everybody is like, I mean, if you're from California, you may as well be like, I mean, we don't want anything to do with you. It's like, go away. The downgrading of the reputation of California has been truly remarkable in my lifetime. Just amazing. And that is that's kind of what I see here, what they're talking about, how all these people left Russia, and they either went to Germany or England or the United States. And where they've gone, they have taken their communism with them, and they have essentially polluted and poisoned everywhere that they've gone. And this, you know, it doesn't need to be Jews, but it's just people with the mentality of this communistic ideology. So anyway, that was just that little, that rings, I don't know. It struck a chord with me, I guess. December of 1893, French Red bombs the chamber of the deputies. The French anarchist August Valiant threw a homemade bomb device from the public gallery of the French Chamber of Deputies. The explosion injured 20 French deputies but failed to kill anybody. Valiant was sentenced to death and executed in February of 1894. His last words were, "Death to the bourgeoisie. Long live anarchy." June of 1894, Reds assassinate President of France. The popular French president, Marie-Franco's Sadi Carnot, had a reputation for honesty and was untouched by the massive Panama Canal scandal of the 1890s. He established a friendship with Russian Tsar Alexander III, receiving the Order of St. Andrew from the Tsar himself. Carnot's popularity, immunity of blackmail, and close friendship with the hated Tsar make him difficult for the Rothschilds to control. This may explain why Carnot was stabbed to death by the Italian anarchist Sante Geronimo Casario. The murder aroused horror and outrage throughout France. No king or president was safe from the red lunatics of their New World Order masters. August of 1897, Reds murder Prime Minister of Spain. Antonio Canovas was a prime minister of Spain, an advocate of a constitutional monarchy and a supporter of the Catholic Church. This made him a target of the Christian-hating Reds and their Rothschild masters. Red Terror had previously hurled a bomb at Canovas in 1896, but the attempt failed. While internal Red turmoil weakened Spain from within, external U.S. globalists agitated for war with Spain over control of its Cuban and Philippine naval bases. Canovas will not live to see the disastrous Spanish-American War. He was shot dead by Italian Red Michel Angiolillo. Oh God, I'm horrible with that. Angiolillo. Sorry. Therefore, the war began. September of 1898, Reds murder Empress Elizabeth of Austria-Hungary. Elizabeth of Austria was the wife of Emperor Franz Joseph I and thus Empress of Austria and Queen of Hungary. Despite warnings of possible assassination attempts, the 60-year-old Elizabeth traveled incognito to Switzerland. On September the 10th of 1898, Elizabeth and her lady-in-waiting left their hotel on the shore of Lake Geneva to catch a steamship. The two walked along the promenade when a 25-year-old Italian anarchist named Luigi Lucchini approached them. Lucchini stabbed Elizabeth with a 4-inch file inserted into a wooden handle. After Lucchini struck her, the empress collapsed and died soon afterwards. Lucchini was soon apprehended as anger and grief swept Austria-Hungary. July 29, 1900, Reds assassinate the King of Italy. In May of 1900, the Red terrorist Guido Bresci left his home in Paterson, New Jersey, and returned to Italy. He proceeded to stalk King Umberto, arriving in the town of Monza on July 26th. The king, who had survived a Red assassination attempt in 1878, arrived in the evening of the 29th in an open-air carriage and began distributing medals to the Italian athletes gathered. After a short word of congratulations, Umberto descended the platform and got back into his carriage. As he sat, Bresci burst out from the crowd, brandishing a revolver, and fired 4 times. The king died seconds later, having been hit 3 times in the chest. Bresci was tackled by police agents and arrested. February 17, 1905, Reds murder Grand Duke of Russia, the Tsar's uncle. Russia's Grand Duke, Sergei Alexandrovich, was the brother of the late Tsar Alexander III. The father, Alexander II, had been murdered by the Reds in 1881. The Grand Duke met the same fate, same sad fate as his father, when a Red terrorist named Ivan Kalayev hurled a bomb at the Duke's carriage. The bomb landed on his lap, obliterating the Duke and his carriage beyond recognition. Duchess Elizabeth, the Grand Duke's wife, withdrew from public life, founding a convent and dedicating herself to helping the poor. The Reds would eventually murder her and her nun maid in 1918. Wow. They just love to kill. The wedding day of the popular King Alphonse the 13th of Spain and Queen Consort Victoria Eugenia, granddaughter of England's Queen Victoria, was marred by yet another Red assassination plot. Matteo Moral Rocca's bomb, concealed in a bouquet of flowers, was launched at the royal couple from a nearby balcony. The deadly flower bomb missed its mark, but several bystanders died. The New World Order's murderous war against Western civilization waged with the Red fanatics as its foot soldiers showed no signs of stopping. February 1908, radicals assassinate both the king and crown prince of Portugal. The royal bloodbath in Europe continued when Red assassins murdered King Carlos of Portugal, along with his son and the heir to the throne, Prince Luis Felipe. The assassins, Alfredo Costa and Manuel Buicha, were linked to the secret Carboni Society. They had also wanted to murder the queen in the hopes of provoking a revolution. Similar to the case with Abe Lincoln's murder, the assassins were executed on the spot before they could talk, suggesting that the conspiracy may have included elements within the government. Although panic ensued, A revolution does not materialize. Prince Manuel, younger son of the king, succeeded his father. September 1911, Reds assassinate the prime minister of Russia. More bloodshed in Europe. Russian prime minister Peter Stolypin was a dedicated reformer who wanted to improve the quality of life for Russia's peasants. When it came to dealing with violent Red revolutionaries, Stolypin was a hardliner, but he also understood that a thriving and growing middle class was critical to preventing the Reds from gaining support among the poor and uneducated. While attending a performance at the Kiev Opera House, and the popular prime minister was shot at close range by Dmitry Borgrov, born Mordecai Gurzhevich. God, I'm horrible with these names. Bagrov was a member of the Okhrana, a Russian police force that had been infiltrated by Red spies. The murder of Russia's prime minister was carried out in the front of the Tsar and his two eldest daughters. November 1912, Reds murdered another prime minister of Spain, the liberal reformer Jose Canales, became prime minister in 1910. While in office, he worked to turn Spain into a more democratic state, but that was not good enough for the Reds. While shopping in a Madrid bookstore, the dude was fatally shot by anarchist Manuel. Golly, why do they have to make these names? Pardinas, I guess I can actually say that. It's kind of like Partain, right? Let's see. April 1917. Exiled Red began returning to Russia. The terrorist Red leaders that Tsar Nicholas had only exiled in 1905 began returning to Russia. Vladimir Lenin arrived from Switzerland via Germany with a stash of Western banker gold. Leon Trotsky arrived from New York with more money and a gang of Marxist Jewish thugs. The well-funded communists immediately undermined the new provisional government. A violent coup was attempted in July, but the Bolshevik Reds were held back. Democratic socialist Alexander Kerensky became prime minister as Bolshevik leaders went underground. Let's see here. It's October of 1917. Socialist prime minister Kerensky struggled to keep a bad economy afloat, an unstable coalition government together, and a tired Russian nation in the war. The time was ripe for the Reds to stage another violent attempt at power. This time, Trotsky, Lenin, and their evil gang would succeed. With backing from some Red troops, many of whom had been brainwashed in 1905 Japanese POW camps by communist reading materials paid for by globalist banker Jacob Schiff, the capital city of Petrograd was seized during the October Revolution. Kerensky fled for his life, and the new Soviet regime soon pulled Russia out of World War I. Outside of Petrograd, the predominantly Jewish Red government was not recognized as legitimate. A bloody civil war between the Jewish-led Reds and the Christian Whites was now in the making. 1918 to 1921, Reds versus Whites, the Civil War in Russia. After the fall of St. Petersburg, the Reds, a counter-revolutionary civil war, tore Russia apart for three more years. The various opponents of the Reds, collectively referred to as the Whites, were led mainly by Admiral Kolchak. When it became apparent that Red Revolutionary Army, composed solely of workers and some ex-Tsarist troops, were far too small to put down the counter-revolution, Trotsky instituted mandatory conscription of the peasantry into the Red Army. Opposition to Red Army conscription was overcome by terror tactics. Hostages and their families were tortured and killed when necessary to force compliance. July 16th of 1918, Tsar Nicholas and his entire family were brutally murdered. Tsar Nicholas II had hoped to be exiled to the UK while Kerensky was in power, but his British ally had refused to take him in. The Bolsheviks now held Nicholas, his wife Alexandra, four daughters, and young son under house arrest. They were forced to live on rations. As a boy, Nicholas had witnessed the bombing murder of his grandfather, Alexander II, in 1881. Nicholas's tragic error was in failing to execute the Red scum such as Lenin and Trotsky after their failed 1905 revolution. Now his misguided mercy had returned to haunt him and his family. On the evening of July 16, 1918, the royal Romanov family was awakened at 2 a.m., told to dress, and then herded into the cellar of the house in which they were being held. Moments later, Jewish Reds stormed in and gunned down the entire family, their doctor, and three servants in cold blood. some of the Romanov daughters had to be stabbed and clubbed to death when the initial gunfire failed to kill them. News of the brutal murder of the Romanovs again shocked Russia and all of Christian Europe. 1918, Lenin and Trotsky established the Communist International. As the Russian Civil War raged on, the Communist International, known as Comintern, was established in Moscow, Russia. The Comintern stated openly that its intention was to fight by all available means, including armed force, for the overthrow of the international bourgeoisie, the entrepreneurial class, and for the creation of an international Soviet republic or a world government. From 1918 to 1922, the Comintern affiliated parties formed in France, Italy, China, Germany, Spain, Belgium, and the United States, all communists, operated under the direction of the Soviets, who themselves were financed by the same globalist bankers that created the Federal Reserve and brought about the Great War. Globalism and communism marched hand in hand and still do, through the though the former have sometimes lost control of elements of the latter. Let's see, September of 18, the Russian communists used strategic terror to intimidate their white adversaries into submission. On orders from Lenin and Trotsky, the Red Terror was announced by the Jewish Red Yakov Sverdlov. The Red Terror was marked by mass arrests in the middle of the night, executions, and hideously creative tactics out by Jewish-run Cheka, or the secret police. Among the atrocities committed, often in view of victims' family members, were 40,000 white prisoners publicly hanged in the Ukraine. Burning, when they say white, they don't mean white people, they mean like Christians. Burning coals inserted into women's vaginas, crucifixions, rape of women of all ages, victims submerged in boiling oil or tar, victims doused with petrol and burned alive, victims placed in coffins filled with hungry rats, victims soaked with water and turned into human ice cubes in winter. Priests, monks, and nuns have molten lead poured in their throats. The demoralizing terror took a heavy psychological toll on the frightened Russian people. By 1922, many were broken into submission to the Cheka monsters. God. Man, that just hurts to even read that stuff. Good Lord. That gives me the eebie-jeebies. In November 1918, as Jewish communists capture Berlin, Germany, the Kaiser flees to Holland. In 1915, Jewish Reds Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht founded the Spartacus League, named after Illuminati founder Adam Weishaupt's code name Spartacus. In 1919, the group became the Communist Party of Germany. That same month, the Spartacists, aided by Jewish Hungarian Red Bela Kun, took advantage to the post-war chaos and staged a coup in Berlin. Kaiser Wilhelm, fearing the same fate as Tsar Nicholas, fled to Holland. He now regretted his past liberalism and denounced the Jewish influence that had ruined Germany. The communist takeover of Berlin was short-lived, as the veterans known as the Freikorps reclaimed control from the Reds. Luxemburg and Liebknecht were captured and executed, as the Freikorps saved Germany from the same deadly fate that befell Russia. But the new democratic socialist Germany will soon face other serious problems. Just like the hardcore Reds of Prussia had pushed aside the socialist Kerensky, the Reds of Germany will keep trying to grab absolute power from the Democratic Socialists of Germany. 1921 to 1922, war communism starves 10 million to death. Lenin's oppression of the Russian peoples broke their strength and will to resist. The famine of 1921 was partially due to the folly of central economic planning, as well as to the deliberate effort to kill off any Russians not willing to support the Red takeover. The communists ran the money printing presses to finance their civil war and Marxist schemes. While inflation followed, they imposed price controls, causing farmers to lose money by farming. Compounding the shortage was the red seizures of seeds. The horrific famine was then used to selectively feed regions submissive to the Reds and starve out those loyalist to the whites. Starving Russians and Ukrainians resorted to eating grass or even cannibalizing the dead. The horror escalated when Lenin deliberately blocked foreign relief efforts. When the death toll reached 10 million, Lenin finally allowed relief. Were it not for mostly American aid, the death toll for Lenin's cruelty would have doubled. I think I'm going to stop there, guys. This just keeps going. Let me find it here. There it is, right there. All right. Might have doubled right there. All right. I'm gonna stop it there, guys. Whew. This is tough. Man, I know it's hard for you guys to listen. You have the luxury of being able to turn it off. I'm reading it. So, and man, it's brutal. A lot of you guys have seen me watch, when I played the first thing of the communist, was episode one of Europa, kind of like what this is what they were trying to fight against. That's one of those things that's really difficult to watch. It's just very hard for me to watch, and it's hard for me to read. So. Yeah, it is very morbid, but you know what? It is morbid, but it's also important to understand. They're drawing. He's basically doing the same thing that in many respects that the that Europa did. Europa was setting the stage for what Hitler was trying to save from Europe. You know, everybody says that Hitler wanted to take over the world. That no, he didn't want to take over the world, but he was trying to protect Western Europe from the Bolsheviks. That's what was going on there. He didn't want to take over the world. But this, in a similar fashion, what Mike is doing here by putting all this stuff out there, he's trying to show what McCarthy was trying to do to prevent that from happening in the United States. You know, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Weathermen. The Weather Underground was a group of basically communists in the United States. And actually, I'm going to look this up. Let's see here. Weather Underground. Or let's see, elimination of those who won't convert. Let's see if you can find it. The Weather Underground. Eckstein wrote that let's see if this is it. The Weather Underground, also known as the Weathermen, was a radical left violent extremist group that was active from the late 1960s through the mid-1970s. What became known as the Weather Underground began in 1969 as Weathermen, a dominant faction within Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS, a left-wing turned revolutionary communist organization that split apart shortly after the founding of Weathermen. In separate books dealing with the history of the Weathermen, professional historian Arthur Eckstein and Vanity Fair journalist Brian Burrow used law enforcement documents and personal recollections of numerous former weather leaders to demonstrate that through at least May of 1970, the organization aggressively promoted efforts to kill police officers and military personnel as part of its goal of sparking the violent overthrow of the United States government. While no murders have been conclusively tied to the weathermen, police officers were injured in at least two weathermen attacks. As late as 2003, several former weathermen leaders were the subject of federal probe into the February 1970 bombing murder of a San Francisco, California police officer that occurred 2 days after the known weatherman bombing that injured police in nearby Berkeley. I'll find it and have it for tomorrow. But the point is that these guys wanted to have this revolution. And this is in the United States. And they literally had a plan for what were they going to do if people like you and I wouldn't convert to their ideology. And they literally were sitting in a room plotting on how they were going to kill like 50 to 70 million Americans. That's literally what we're dealing with here. The people who were trying to turn this country into a communist utopia are literally, if we don't, I don't mean to sound, hyperbolic, but it's literally a fight to the death. And people like us, you know, look at what happened. Look at what happened in Germany. Look at what happened in Russia. You know, when these people, when these communists wanted to overthrow the government, and then their overthrow was stopped, and then they were given a sentence or exiled or something. They were kicked out of the country, and then ultimately they came back and did and accomplished what their objective was. Well, that's because the people who they failed to overthrow had, I don't want to say mercy, but that's the wrong word, but they literally they banished them. What they need to do is they just need, this is going to sound brutal, but really what you have to do is you have to kill them. You literally, and this kind of goes back to how the stories in the Bible, when God told the Israelites, when you go in there, kill everything, kill it all, kill everything, even the animals, kill everything. You don't want to have any trace of anything left because of how they lived. And I kind of believe that that's kind of what we're facing here. I mean, as sad as it sounds, I'm not advocating violence. But what I'm saying is that if it ever came down to a situation where we got into a conflict, you know, it's a kill or be killed mindset. And the people who literally want to force this on us, if we won't conform to them, they'll kill us. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. That is historical fact. That's what they do. So I'm going to go through and read some of the comments, because I've been reading. I haven't looked at any of the comments here tonight, and you guys have been in here chatting it up. Let's see here. I'm probably just going to skim a lot of this here, guys. How do these people pop up during history and become so influential like Marx? Yeah, well, and I'll tell you, I don't think they just pop up and become, I don't think they just pop up. I think they're people like Marx are promoted. Did I skip a couple paragraphs? Sorry. Yeah, exactly. Elders of Zion. I don't know, remember what I skipped. Sorry, guys. I'm still kind of tired. Even though I slept a little bit last night, it's the last couple of days have been kind of brutal on me. Have mercy, please. I'm glad you get a hold of our kids' minds. Exactly. Yeah. 100%, Colin. Right there with you. You know, it's interesting. Yeah, you're talking about your kids are so busy trying to survive and take care of kids that they don't want to get into politics, but they have exposure, I'm sure, later. Yeah, well, it's, you know what? What's really going to happen is when the when a lot of this stuff comes to pass and they are forced to... When it comes to their doorstep, they're going to be forced to have to, they're going to have to act. So they're going to have to pick a side at some point. Let's see here. Yes, they are. Sometimes they're hard to pronounce. Actually, the Spanish names aren't hard to pronounce. It's the Italian names one, and the and especially the Russians. Oh my God, those are brutal. Yes, all wars are Brinker's wars. Hello, Avery. How are you? Yeah, exactly. This is, yeah, okay. I think I'm getting caught up here. Yes, Obama's funders and controllers, absolutely. They're straight from the Weather Underground. That's Bill Ayers. William Ayers, man, he was, yeah, brutal. Yeah, it's exactly what I did, Colin. I want to say it was when I first did it. It was, in fact, here. Let me share my screen and we'll look for it, so you guys know what to look for. So you know what to look for. Okay. Here we are. This is... Man, it's amazing. When I go and I look through some of this stuff and I see how many videos I've done, it's kind of astonishing to me how far back it was. I mean, look, I'm on page 6. So this is the one. It's called Why We Fight. This is the one. Now, one of the things that I did before I did the Why We Fight is I did the rabbis and the members of the Jewish community discuss 1930s Germany. And I started with that on purpose. And if any of you guys ever want to talk about this stuff and, you know, you it's difficult for you to talk about, you know, like the Jewish community, go to this video. This is an important one. It's called Rabbis and Members of the Jewish Community Discuss 1930s Germany. But Why We Fight, the Red Menace is Very Real. This is the first part of Europa, I believe. Just double check it. Maybe not. Yeah, I think this is right. I paused it quite a bit talking about it. So, but yeah, that's the one. That was the one. So the red menace is real. So, yes, Colin, they're right. They prey on mercy. Yes, Dredard, it's us or them, nothing in between. 1,000% agree. No, it's not difficult to talk about it, but it's difficult for me to read. I will say that it is difficult for me to read and to watch. It's hard. It's hard on me. The older I get, the harder it is for me to deal with stuff like this. But I also recognize that it's important to do it. You have to do it. If you want to find, but if you want to find it and you don't want to find it with, you don't want to watch it with me interrupting and pausing it, just go to BitChute and look up Europa. It's easy to find. So, all right, everybody. Well, I think I've done quite a bit for today. I really truly appreciate all you guys. So many of you are, I only recognize you as names in the chat, and times that you post in the comment section, but there's a lot of people who never say anything, but they watch the shows that I do. All you guys that faithfully watch the stuff I do, I sincerely appreciate you. It's kind of humbling in a way. It's like, I can't believe that somebody that's just doing something on here is like that people know the stuff that I do. It's just, it's kind of fun, you know? And so, it's humbling. But I appreciate it though. I really do. So, all right, everybody. Well, you have a wonderful evening, and tomorrow is going to be fun. I don't know if I'm going to read any from the book tomorrow, but I may. I may not. I know for certain we're going to be watching. We're going to do the watch party of the Gulag. That there's not really any blood or guts or anything in that. So. It's going to be fun. It'll be a lot of fun. So, you guys and have a fantastic evening, and I look forward to seeing you mañana. So, I got my, yeah. Well, thank you, Colin, for saying that. I've got my website up, but I had some, obviously I wanted to get my shirts and stuff. I had some shirts and stuff that I wanted to do, just with some of like this is kind of like this one right here where, it says a lie doesn't become truth just because it's accepted by the majority. Got some of those coming, if you guys want to have something like that, you can wear it. So, but those are coming. I just, this week has been rough. but probably next week when I have, got a lot of downtime, I'll get a lot of that stuff done, get a lot of caught up stuff. So anyway, you guys all have a wonderful evening, and I look forward to seeing you mañana. Have a good night.